Hi there, I'm Jason Schulman, and this is New Books in Australian and New Zealand Studies. My guest today is Jane McCabe. She's a lecturer in the Department of History and Art History at the University of Otago. She's here to talk about her new book, Race, Tea, and Colonial Resettlement, Imperial Families Interrupted, published by Bloomsbury Academic in May 2017. Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. So Jane, tell us, you know, we'll start kind of broadly and then maybe zoom in. Who are the Kalimpong kids?
So the Kalimpong kids is a name that I've given to a group of Anglo-Indian adolescents who emigrated to New Zealand between 1908 and 1938. So there were 130 of them altogether. Approximately even numbers of young men and young women, and they were all sent to New Zealand via a Scottish Presbyterian mission scheme that saw them, most of them were taken from tea plantations and sent to New Zealand via a mission school in a place called Kalimpong in northeast India.
So there are these tea families in northeastern India, the adolescents, right, teenagers, early 20s, mm-hmm. are mixed race, and this Dr. John Graham enters the picture. Who is he?
Mm-hmm. So John Graham was he was a missionary in Kalimpong for 10 years before he opened this institution. So his role in Kalimpong, one of his tasks was to go out to tea planters on these quite isolated estates around Darjeeling and Assam. So Kalimpong is quite neatly placed in the centre of those two districts. And so one thing that he noticed when he was travelling around to the plantations was that a lot of these tea planters had apparently engaged in relationships with local women, and they had children who were often living with them in the bungalow. Now, some of those tea planters were, they wanted to hide the fact of these children's existences, but others actually talked to Graham about the problem that they felt the children presented in terms of if they wanted to take responsibility for the children's future, they had quite limited opportunities to do that. So at this time, those kind of interracial relationships were seriously frowned on. So they couldn't send the children back to Britain or take them back to Britain when they inevitably retired from the tea industry. And they also often weren't accepted on their maternal side either. So over the 10 years between 1890 and 1900 that John Graham was doing his mission work in Kalimpong, he started to formulate this plan for an institution that would provide for the future of these young people.
Mm-hmm. And eventually he comes up with the idea of sending these teens and early 20s young people to New Zealand. So what motivated him?
So yes, this colonial vision was central to the school that he started in Kalimpong, even though, as it turned out, most of the children who went through that institution would end up being placed in India. But certainly, so later in life, John Graham made statements like he believed that New Zealand was the best place in the world for the boys and girls of Kalimpong. But at the outset, he was very much open to these children going to any of the settler colonies. So the idea was that he accepted that there was no place for the children in Britain. He accepted that there was no place for them in India, but he thought that there would be a place in settler colonies because he saw them as kind of living up to these egalitarian reputations that they were developing, which was particularly the case in New Zealand, which by this stage already had quite a long history of interracial relationships and a kind of acceptance of mixed race populations. But the other reason was quite pragmatic, I think, and that was just that the settler colonies were really crying out for labourers. So for men, there was a great need for farm workers and for women domestic workers. And so this was really how he built that institution, was around these settler colonial labour shortages.
How did the parents of these Anglo-Indian children feel about this plan?
So I guess we'd have to talk about the mothers and the fathers very separately here. So I think what distinguishes this scheme from other schemes that sought to improve mixed-race children in other parts of the British Empire was that the fathers actually had, it was them that decided to send the children to Kalimpong. So John Graham ran this as a private institution, so it wasn't officially supported by the church. It had some state funding, but it wasn't a state scheme either. He was reliant on the tea planters to send the children to Kalimpong and to pay fees. So it was almost more like a boarding school than a kind of state institution where children were removed. So the fathers had a lot of power in sending their children to Kalimpong. We know less about what the mothers wanted for their children because they were essentially erased from the written record. But anecdotally, it seems that the mothers were quite resistant to the children being sent to Kalimpong. And I think certainly they would have had very little understanding of the eventual outcome of being sent to Kalimpong, which was that they would be sent much further away to the settler colonies and ultimately to New Zealand, which meant that the chances of them ever seeing their children again were practically zero.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating story and you know, probably very little known until you uncovered this research, but there's actually another dimension to it, and that is the story of Lorna Peters. So tell us who she was.
So Lorna Peters was my grandmother. And I suppose for me, for the majority of my life, the way that I thought about my grandmother's history was that it was quite interesting, it was intriguing, but I felt that it was completely mysterious and unknowable. So we knew that she was born on a tea plantation because she had some tea memorabilia at her house here in Dunedin in New Zealand. We knew that her mother had been Indian because she had quite dark skin. But other than that, we didn't know anything about why or how Lorna and her two siblings came to New Zealand. So it was really a great mystery and one that I never thought I would be able to solve simply because we didn't have any written records that I knew of. And Lorna died in 1978 when I was 5 years old. So the opportunity to ask her anything disappeared from that time on. So it wasn't until 2007 when I was planning a trip to India and I visited my dad, who was by this time living in Lorna's old house. And so I just took that opportunity to ask him one more time if there was anything amongst Lorna's things that would give me somewhere to go, like some clue, a place or a name that I could go to in India to perhaps look up her past. And it was at that point that he brought out a packet of photographs that had a group photograph of a number of girls, perhaps 20 or 30 girls, lined up in front of a rough cast building, and it had Kalimpong School written on the envelope, and it had the names of all the girls written on the back. So Lorna and her younger sister were both in that photograph, and so that was the very concrete kind of clue that led me to Kalimpong and to uncovering not just Lorna's story, but this story of the bigger scheme of sending children to New Zealand.
That is just an incredible story. And when you got to the school, which is still standing, right?
Yes, it is, yeah.
There was a bit of a luck in finding some old archival material. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It was, but I guess it's kind of the standard Indian experience to some extent, where you just have to put yourself in the right place and wait for the opportunities to arise. So when I first arrived at the school, I just had this photograph with me, and the headmaster there, who I located quite quickly, was very interested in my story, but he was quite new to the school, so he wasn't sure how to help me. And then a couple of people arrived and said we could take you to the museum. So the school, it has a very different function now. It's basically just known as a very good private English school in India, but they've kept the records from the very first pupil onwards. So in this museum they have this amazing admissions book, so the original admissions book in a glass case, which I was given the opportunity to look through to find my grandmother's name. They also had bound copies of all of the school magazines, which were published from, I think, the first year, so from 1901. And then from the museum, I was taken down to the school office, where I discovered that they kept a file for every student who's ever been to Dr. Graham's homes in Kalimpong. So that was probably the most amazing moment for me, was to have this archivist pop out to a small room in the back of this little office and come back in about 2 minutes flat with my grandmother's file, which you know, had been created over 100 years before, and I guess no one had ever looked at since she left the school in 1920.
Wow. I want to zoom out again a little bit. How does the story of the Kalimpong Kings, the Kalimpong Kids, tell us, what does it tell us about, you know, identities and kind of the creation and the forgetting of narratives, especially New Zealand?
Yeah. Well, so I guess that's what really interests me, and something, I wrote a PhD thesis on this topic, and one of the main ways that I wanted to find out about this experience was to contact other descendants of the Kalimpong Kids. And so I guess the most startling pattern that I discovered from speaking to all of these families was that the original Kalimpong Kids didn't like to talk about this background. So it was very much about silence. So that went from everything from not talking about it to refusing to answer questions to outright concealment and lying about it. So for me, this has become, for the book, this was my major research question, really, was to think about how those kinds of personal silences affect the way that we write history. So if a story is not even known amongst a family, how is it ever going to make it into the public record? And I mean, this is something I quite often do public talks about the Kalimpong Kids, and people will come and talk to me afterwards and say, I've never heard about this before. How have I never heard about it? And my response is always, I'd never heard about it, and my own grandmother was one of them. So that that process by which stories make it into the public record is one that's of ongoing interest to me.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that is kind of larger than any one story is the change in immigration rules. How did that affect Graham's plan in the 1920s and 1930s?
Yeah, so this is something where the Kalimpong Kids story really challenges the way that historians have characterized the immigration, or the history of immigration restriction in New Zealand. So when Graham opened the homes in 1900, this was right at the time where the settler colonies were passing another wave of restrictions on non-British communities. Now, in between 1900 and 1920, he still managed to get groups into New Zealand, it seems, with relative ease. So the way that he managed this obvious anxiety in New Zealand about the racial composition of their populations was to send relatively small groups and to disperse them quite widely so that they would just be integrated quietly into local communities. Now, in 1920, there was an amendment to the Immigration Restriction Act, which New Zealand historians generally regard as a landmark in our immigration restriction policy, in the way that it gave complete discretion to the customs minister to decide who could come into New Zealand and who couldn't. So in terms of Chinese and Indian communities, 1920 is seen as kind of the cutoff point, so where the potential for a new migrant, so one who didn't have family in New Zealand already, from India or China to come into New Zealand was basically impossible. So the Kalimpong Kids scheme really challenges that, because although there was great consternation at the homes in Kalimpong about what this new legislation would mean, actually more Kalimpong Kids came into New Zealand in the 1920s than had in the 20 years before. And so the reason for that, I argue in the book, is that the Presbyterian connections, the Scottish Presbyterian connections that John Graham was able to gather around the scheme in New Zealand kind of outweighed that racial anxiety. So it really contributes to what we know about how the policies beneath that legislation worked in New Zealand.
Last question before I let you go, Jane. At the end of the book, and I was really happy that you told us this, because I was worried that we weren't going to find out. But you do find out your great grandmother's name. What was that like, learning that information?
Yeah, that was great, and it's something that I haven't followed up to date, but something that I probably should. That actually happened through another branch of the family. So my great-grandfather, the tea planter, was quite unusual in that he followed his daughter to New Zealand. But because of that, he basically dropped off his own family tree in England. And around the same time in 2007, when I went to Kalimpong, a member of his extended family in England who was doing their family tree kind of discovered us in Dunedin and made contact with us, and it was actually he who located the name of Lorna's mother, which was Jupri Gurkhali. So it's wonderful to have her name, but again, I would say it's quite difficult to really be able to follow that up. That's partly due to the fragmented nature of the history of Northeast India, really, because what that name tells us is that she was Nepali, but it's quite difficult to trace because of the history of migration to the tea plantations from Nepal over quite a long period of time. But certainly other descendants of the Kalimpong kids would give anything, really, to have a name for the great-grandmother.
Jane, I want to thank you for being on the show today. That's Jane McCabe. Her new book is Race, Tea, and Colonial Resettlement: Imperial Families Interrupted. It's published by Bloomsbury Academic in May 2017. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.